Washington. My name is Lee Hoffheimer. I'm with the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And just to make sure you are where you think you are, you're on a webinar, What Do You Say When She Says Yes?, that is co-presented by the Coalition and with HHS Office on Women's Health, Region 10. And with me in the room is Renee Bouvillon. She is the Regional Women's Health Coordinator. And we're going to be starting this webinar. As you can, just to remind everyone, you are all on mute at this time. We've had quite a lot of interest, which is great. So we will have breaks during the call where I'm hoping you all can send in your questions by using the chat feature. We'll have some structured breaks. You'll see webinar slides that indicate that. We'll look at your questions, and I will be verbally responding to some of them, and we'll be pulling together some shared themes. And I think some of you who may be familiar with webinar features know there's a raising hand feature, but we're not going to be responding to that. We're going to be using the chat feature. So we're going to get started. Waiting for our slide to advance. I'm back. We think we've figured it all out. So what we will cover. So today I know we have a range of folks here who are very experienced in the healthcare setting and probably have been doing screening for a while regarding domestic violence and sexual violence, but we're just going to do a little bit of preliminary stuff to get us all on the same page. So today we'll be looking a little bit at prevalence and related healthcare costs. We're going to look at some practical strategies for implementing our practices. We're going to look at responding to the disclosure of domestic violence. I'm going to make sure you all have a comfortable understanding about domestic violence advocacy and leave you with some resources as well. Just to tell you a little bit about my background, I did start back in the mid-80s working on a hotline as a domestic violence advocate. I've worked in direct service programs. I've worked in shelters. I've worked in the courtroom setting. I've been a legal advocate. I've worked with the healthcare system over many years, and now I'm at the Coalition working on supporting our direct service program advocates and the women and children they serve, as well as working on public policy. So I'm hoping that we can, that range of experience will help in this conversation. So prevalence. So this is from a February 2008 Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study. I think we all know this, but just to give you all some information that you can use back in your setting to talk about the problem and why it's important to be prepared to respond to domestic violence. I think this study is really important as well to point out that most of the violence that people are experiencing, including men, are at the hands of men. So that's not to say that we don't recognize that men can be victims of abuse, and that we know abuse occurs in bi, trans, lesbian, and gay relationships as well. But today we're going to be talking about teen and adult intimate partner violence as opposed to focusing on child abuse or abuse with specifically with the elderly or vulnerable adults, though again we know domestic violence can occur among relationships where folks are elderly, so we'll be crossing that spectrum. But we just wanted to let you know that we are narrowing our focus a little bit today, and we will be talking about intimate partner violence. The next study I wanted to share, which I thought was interesting, this is an interesting CDC study. So they first gathered this data back in 1995, and they were looking at the costs, healthcare costs of domestic violence, looking at medical care, mental health services, lost productivity in the workplace. And at that time, back in 1995, they were estimating the cost at $5.8 billion. Then they recalculated those dollars in 2003 and see that's more than $8.3 billion. So again, I think it's good information if you've got folks in management or supervising position who don't understand possibly the importance of getting staff trained on being able to respond to domestic violence or why a certain amount of time could be spent, is that there are real costs that we can all help reduce over time. In 2010, there was a group health study here in Washington State, as you can see in this slide, that found that female domestic violence victims had significantly higher health care costs for 3 years following the end of abuse than women who have not been abused. So this study was the first to look at how health care costs of abused women changed from year to year after the abuse ended. It looked at the cost during the years of the abuse and then during each year after, up to 10 years. What they found is by the fourth year following the end of exposure to intimate partner violence, health care costs among intimate partner violence exposed women were similar to non-abused women, and this pattern held for the remainder of the 10-year study. So what we can conclude for that is that interventions to reduce the growth of intimate partner violence or to mitigate the impact of intimate partner violence have the potential to reduce the rate of growth of health care costs generally. So it, to me, it suggests that domestic abuse acts on health care costs much like chronic health conditions. The prolonged impact of abuse on health care costs is consistent with what we might find with people who quit smoking or stop abusing alcohol or drugs, but the costs don't go back to normal for many years. So again, it's another reason why we want to be able to figure out how to be comfortable in responding to domestic violence. Because we know that, we all know, you all know, that there are costs that are beyond what you're seeing right in front of you, and that the impact of the violence that the person is experiencing or the other kind of coercive behaviors are far-reaching and long-term. So we're going to just do a little bit of thinking about what domestic violence, what everyone might think domestic violence, the impact of domestic violence might look like in their healthcare setting, or what they think might be the first sort of general understanding of what domestic violence is about. And I think, given our time, we just have to sort of focus on some really important factors. And one of them is the myth that leaving would equal safety. We know that leaving doesn't equal safety. And I bet many of you all know that now, because you talk to patients, you see people over a period of time, through their pregnancies, through their conditions, you might see them, you might hear them talking to you about leaving their partner, returning to their partner, and so you understand that. But it is still pretty surprising how many people out sort of in the general public think if they would just leave this person, they would be safer. So we have some information to help, again, give you some tools to explain to people why leaving doesn't equal safety. In Washington State and in many states across the country, there many coalitions have projects that are called fatality review projects. And what these projects mainly are about is doing kind of a post-mortem on deaths that are a result of domestic violence and seeing where the gaps in systems in the response to domestic violence. So in our state, we've got a fatality review project, and the next information that's on the slides that we're going to talk about is going to help underscore why leaving doesn't equal safety. Doesn't mean we don't want people to lead violence-free lives, but it'll help explain why leaving has to be planned and why it is complicated, and that you have to think about what's going to happen and how the abuser is going to react, or the person who's doing the abuse, once they know the person's interested in leaving. So one of the things that we learned out of our findings and in Washington State over the, we've been doing this project since 2000, and this is from the 2008 report. We do these every couple of years, and they're all available for free on our website, so you can look at recommendations that are there for healthcare providers. There's an index available as well as other information. But from the homicides that we studied in Washington State, what we saw is at least 47% of the homicides by abusers, the victim had left the abuser or was trying to leave. And most of these folks that were killed that we looked at in our study, that the act of actually being killed might be the first act of physical violence they experienced, but they experienced long-term other kind of coercive acts of violence or coercive acts of abuse, isolating from friends and family, monitoring folks' behavior, not giving them access to funding, restricting who they could see, basically trying to monitor and control their daily life and action, which from the outside, those aren't illegal acts, and those can seem complicated. So the actual homicide might have been the first physical violence they experienced. So what we learn from this is that leaving and starting to talk about the abuse you're experiencing to anyone is a dangerous time. So again, this comes from our Fatality Review Study and what we learned from looking at the police reports and any other kind of records of folks that had contact with folks in the medical system or CPS or DSHS or religious leaders or housing or advocates in their community. These fatality review panels are held in each community locally, and we bring people together that touch the lives of the victim's family, the homicide victim's family. And so the times that are dangerous is when folks are, or increased dangerousness, I should say, are planning to leave or they're leaving, they've filed for any kind of order, maybe the order's being served, the victim begins to talk to other people about what's happening, custody exchange for around children. Any system begins to hold the abuser accountable. For instance, you know, there's a protection order at your workplace, and your workplace provider says, you know, I have to put you on a different shift. You can't be on the same shift as your partner. Or the school system says, I'm sorry, we have a copy of this order. You're not supposed to be picking up your child. We're not going to let you do it. And other things, when we see the abuser is taking greater risk to control, so they don't care who knows that they're looking for their partner. They don't care who's aware that they're upset. So those are all indications of danger or increased dangerousness. Every person who's abusive is different. There isn't a cookie cutter mold. But these are things that, so they're not, these things aren't necessarily predictive, but we do understand that some folks who are abusive are more dangerous than others. And these are times that we need to keep in mind around planning for safety, planning for the reaction of the person who's abusive, once your patient has decided to start talking about abuse. Again, if we're thinking about folks who've been killed by their abuser, so we're talking about a subset of people who are abusive, then we can talk a little bit more about trying to identify increased dangerousness that was had in common with other survivors or other victims who were killed. So the bad news is there isn't any foolproof assessment tool that exists. Many of you may have seen lethality assessment tools or seen things like that out there. But what we do know is the things that can help us identify whether someone is in an increasingly dangerous situation or not is really happens through routine screening, not just asking once, but asking several times, asking throughout a woman's pregnancy, asking at different times if people are coming in for tests, not just coming in routinely for physical exams or breast exams or any other kind of interaction you might have, but asking more than once. If someone tells you that they do fear for their life, ask why, and we'll talk more about that. So we've learned that we can identify some of the signs of increased risk, but I want to say again that it's not predictive because, again, as I said earlier in looking at the fatality review data, sometimes a person's first experience of physical violence was the actual homicide and may not have ever had any contact with the criminal legal system. But looking at all the information we've had over the years and reviewing deaths, this is some of the things that we can say that point to signs of increased risks. If someone says that they fear for their life, if someone is being stalked, and we've seen too many of those in the headlines, if the abuser actually makes homicidal threats, or if the person who's abusive makes suicidal threats. And we'll just talk for a moment about that. Often when folks are abusive, folks who are suicidal, we have a standard of care, and most of us have protocols and procedures about how you're supposed to be dealing with that. But if you know domestic violence is going on in this relationship, and either party says they're suicidal, it's important to ask the other party if they're suicidal. Because again, we know if an abuser is suicidal, he or she may believe they have less to lose, and we know from looking at homicides that occur in the context of domestic violence, it is a sign of increased dangerousness. So it's important, if you know domestic violence is present, if either party says that they're suicidal, to ask. Strangulation, if someone's experienced strangulation, threats with use of weapons, again, if the person who's abusive is taking greater risks, if the violence is escalating quickly, and if substance abuse is combined with any of the above. So again, just to reiterate, we're looking at a subset of folks who are more dangerous than other abusers. I don't want to give the impression that everybody who walks into your office who discloses abuse is a possible homicide victim at the next moment, but to be able to have some familiarity with increasing signs of risk and dangerousness could be helpful, but to know there's many things you can do to help strengthen someone's safety and plan for their future and not fear at any moment that they're going to be a homicide victim. Okay, so we're going to take a little break and look at some of your questions, and I will get back to you. So we just had an interesting question from one of the participants asking if someone is throwing away the belongings of a person, could that be a sign of domestic violence? I think that's... I think that's a really good question. I think you're having some good insight. So if... Yes, it can be a sign of domestic violence, and, you know... In that, what is that person throwing away? They're throwing away clothing or shoes that's meaningful to someone. And we've heard of people who are abusive destroying possessions that are important to the other person, because throwing away someone's shoes could limit them from, you know, freedom of movement, keeping them from escaping out of a situation. Just maybe there's not a lot of money to replace the clothing articles that have been taken. So we have to really think about what's the intention of the person who's being abusive. Because domestic violence isn't about losing your temper or single incidents of violence, but it's really intentional and thinking about how do I maintain dominance in this relationship. And if all I have to do is, because we don't have a lot of money or I don't give this person access to much money, take clothing items that they would need, they're not going anywhere. So it looks like we've got a couple other questions. One moment. We had three great questions. I'm going to respond to, again, one that talks about kinds of tactics abusers would use. There was a question, what about hurting the family animal or a prized animal? Supposing, you know, we've got folks that are working in clinic settings across the state, and I've definitely talked to survivors who said, I'm afraid to leave because he's going to hurt the animals, our prized animals on our farm or our possessions. So, again, the message can be, if I hurt the family pet, what could happen to you all? So if that is enough to maintain dominance in the relationship, then the person who's being abusive doesn't have to do anything directly against the adult. It's about making the adult person or the teen in that relationship think the person has the will and the ability. So, yes, hurting a family pet can be definitely a sign of domestic violence. Another good question that we'll talk about a little bit later on, so I just want to let you know we're getting there, legal steps that a person could take that would be less hurtful or dangerous. I think that's a good question, but we're going to talk about that because it is all going to come back to timing and planning. Okay, so we're going to do a little bit of review. Someone asked a question about screening, so we are going to do a little bit of review and having some sample questions around screening as we talk about what do I do if she says yes. So I just also wanted to throw out there that perhaps this slide or overhead could have read, what do I do if she says no, just as easily, because no is a very common response whether or not DV is present. And some of the things that I, in my experience, and that I think might be helpful to say, whether someone says yes or no to this question, we're going to go through. So if someone actually says no to you at this time first, let's just talk about that a little bit briefly. I think it would be helpful for you to have kind of sample common framing statements that you feel comfortable putting into your own words at your fingertips. Something like, I'm glad to hear there's no abuse right now. Should that ever change, this is a safe place to talk about domestic violence. Or something like, I'm glad all is well for you. This week we're asking all women about safety at home here because domestic violence is such a common experience for women. We're giving this brochure to every woman we see. You may have a friend who might find this useful. Glad to know your partner didn't cause those bruises. I have to tell you, this week alone I saw several women with similar bruises. Some of them told me their partner caused them. That's why I always ask. Sometimes people don't know help is available. Since we've brought up this topic, feel free to take a brochure. You may not need it, but we offer it to everybody just the same, just like we do seatbelt and smoking information. Now, let's see. Have we scheduled your next appointment yet? And we also know that about 95% of women in chemical dependency treatment report some kind of abuse history, whether it's been in the distant past or the present. And so you just want to convey the message that it's a safe place to talk about domestic violence should anyone recall anything that concerns them. Okay, so that's several examples of what you might say to folks if they say, no, nothing's going on. But let's move on to what do I do if she says yes. So I think it's helpful to keep it simple for yourself and to remember and to sort of hold these four things in mind. You don't have to fix it. Advocacy is a really critical intervention, and we'll talk about what I mean by advocacy. That the patient in front of you is the expert on her experience of abuse and knows her abuser best, and will spend a little time talking about documentation. We're going to talk about things that you can directly say to your patient in the moment, including talking about her immediate safety and next steps. Because it feels like it'd be really helpful for folks to have, in the moment, a set of tools that they felt comfortable with. Just before we get into some actual statements, a couple of things I would like to ask you to keep in mind. When we talk about advocates, we're going to be talking about advocates that work in our community-based domestic violence programs. You may actually have an advocate that comes from one of these programs to your clinic or to your hospital. You may actually have folks in your medical setting that you call advocates, but the advocates that are employed by community-based domestic violence programs have very specific expertise and a role in responding to domestic violence. We'll talk about that later. We'll talk about how legal options are how to help make them appropriate in the context of planning for someone's safety and considering how the abuser will respond. And we'll spend some time talking about planning for safety because it's a very specific thing in the field of working against domestic violence. I think generally safety planning, when I ask people what does safety planning mean to them, they say all kinds of stuff like crossing the street safely. That's why I teach my children how to do that, how to ride a bus safely, saving some extra cash, and putting it aside, having an extra change of clothes. So it's in the world of working to respond to domestic violence, planning for safety is a very specific thing, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Again, keeping in mind that the survivor is expert on the abuse she's experiencing, and she will have strategies that she can call upon that she's worked that have helped her in the past, and we'll talk about how you can help surface that a little bit, and strategies that have worked to actually help protect her and her children that from the outside might seem even kind of strange or you don't get how they help her. But in asking her about it and listening to the context in which she used those strategies will make more sense to you. And then we'll talk a little bit about reporting obligations for adult domestic violence. This is a Region 10 call, so I did a little calling around to make sure that to find out what the reporting obligations were for adult domestic violence for Washington, Alaska, Idaho, and Oregon. So we'll have some information about that. So this is just a little framework for you to keep in mind when you're thinking about if you haven't had any experience screening, and these are just sort of a shorthand of steps you can take from screening forward. So once you've screened, responding to the patient in front of you, and through through documentation. And we're going to break this down, break this framework down, and use it to go a little bit deeper and bring out examples of practical strategies for each of these steps. Okay, first, ask. So for folks who maybe haven't had as much experience doing screening, we really suggest direct questions. These are just a couple of examples. You want to normalize the question. You want to ask it of all your patients. You want to practice getting comfortable with it. And you want to make sure that you know what the process, who is asking the question, how they ask that question in your medical setting, and then what do they do, again, if someone responds yes. If it's a medical assistant who's asking these questions and she does get a yes answer or he gets a yes answer, does that mean it goes directly to the doctor or to a nurse who hasn't actually asked the question and seen the response? So you want to think about maybe like who is even asking this question, thinking ahead, because it's hard to have to keep telling your story over and over again from the point of view of the survivor. And when it comes to this question, like other sensitive questions, you want to be thoughtful about who's asking it. Got some more sample questions for you. So again, you'll notice I'm not using the words domestic violence or victim or hit or kick or rape, because most people don't identify themselves as a domestic violence victim, feel uncomfortable with that language, you know, think we're talking about people on the Jerry Springer show or on Oprah, and wouldn't use that. But if you could find language that feels comfortable for you that gets at the coercive nature of abuse, have you felt afraid before? Have you felt controlled or isolated? Does your partner let you have, you know, are you able to be with friends and family? What's it like in your relationship when you argue? You know, just kind of get at more of the coercive nature of abuse. You know, we know that listening to survivors, that many of them say that the emotional abuse leave much longer lasting impact on them than any kind of physical abuse they may have experienced. And again, we know that sexual violence might be the last thing anybody wants to talk to you about without a longer term opportunity to build trust in the relationship. It might be more ready to talk to you about the other kind of coercive nature of abuse they're experiencing. And that may be fine. But you're trying to get at, does this person feel safe once they leave your office, especially if you're responding to any kind of outward signs of abuse. So here's some more samples of questions. And a lot of times when people are saying yes in this setting, and I certainly learned this working in shelter and working on the hotline, just asking people to say, can you tell me more about that? Can you tell me more about that? Just leaving an open-ended question and giving a person an opportunity. Another statement might be, what does that mean to you? I find that's often really helpful because you might only be getting partial information from someone who's talking to you and says, for instance, something like, whenever he puts the briefcase by the front door when he comes in, I know that's trouble. And from the outside, you know, what does the briefcase have to do with trouble? And it wasn't until I asked the survivor, what does that mean to you, that she said, in that briefcase, I know that there's a gun. So she wasn't volunteering that information until I asked her, what does it mean to you? So I just saw a question that came through that I thought was that we might want to comment on a little bit, that you may be working in different communities where folks may not answer you directly, and it may not be part of their culture or their form of expression to answer directly questions about, do you know someone who's being abused? And again, that's where I would, you know your communities and patients best, work for language that doesn't use abuse, kicked, hurt might be, work for language that is more indirect. You know, so do you feel safe in your relationship? Is anyone making you fearful at home if you don't even want to use relationship? I would go for indirect questions as well. When I say direct, I mean don't be afraid to bring up the issue, but being responsive to the folks in front of you is really important. And I assume the person who asked that question understands that there's language that's not going to be as acceptable. Some, you know, so I would be working for words that avoid any of our jargon when we talk about domestic violence and victimization. Okay, let's go to the next. The next piece in the frame was acknowledging. So someone has said, disclose something to you that gives you an indication that they're not feeling comfortable or safe or hoping to get some kind of support from you. So we want to acknowledge that we've heard the person in front of us. Here are some sample statements. You know, survivors experiencing domestic violence are really going to benefit from hearing such supportive statements from you, that anyone could find themselves in this situation, that I'm sure this is not what you expected to happen when you first came together, that it can be painful, and that there, and that this is a time, again, when you can ask, what can I do to support you today? So, again, focusing on what we can do in the moment. You know, these kind of supportive statements, you, again, will find language that works for you. I'm just trying to give you some examples of the intent of the kind of statements, is to help create an atmosphere of safety and trust where that person's not going to feel embarrassed if they didn't tell you the first time, but they told you the next time you saw them or the next time they were there with their children. Again, by asking this question, asking these questions, not when you just see outward signs of injury or you're concerned about the kind of maybe chronic illnesses that are showing up in front of you, but just asking frequently, asking everyone that you see will create this atmosphere that it's this is okay and to expect this from your medical provider. A very famous sort of icon in the anti-domestic violence movement, I remember her always saying that there is a huge impact in just making the survivor know that she's actually being listened to and that we care, that we can't underestimate the power of that small step as well. So barriers to care. One of the things I know we don't have to tell you that there are many barriers to accessing health care for folks that we work with. Language barrier is one of them. Also, folks experiencing a range of disabilities may have trouble accessing health care effectively. Literacy, obviously lack of insurance, and not having staff that maybe understand what people are experiencing or help, or are able to help create a welcoming environment. And so, why I'm bringing this issue up, it's not because I don't think you all don't know that, but what I want to say is that the person who's abusive in the relationship uses societal bias, lack of services, structural inequities in our society against the person they're targeting as well. The abuser will know if there's interpreters available at the healthcare setting where the family goes or not. And we'll use that to further the person's isolation or entrapment. The abuser knows if the person with the disability is either going to have a hard time filling out paperwork or may not be seen as credible. If they're not seen as credible by staff, or, you know, the abuser will use that information to further entrap and isolate the survivor as well. So I'm just heightening that up for you all to think about, that when you're responding, when you're asking about domestic violence, and when you're responding, knowing, just sort of trying to keep that layering in mind, or the compounding impact of a patient in front of you trying to survive the individual tactics of abuse they're experiencing from their partner, as well as knowing the abuser is going to use whatever inequities are going on in your community or in your medical setting, or, you know, not, or the fact that there may not be, you know, buses that have wheelchair lifts, they're going to use all that information to also further entrap or isolate the survivor. And so it's just trying to hold that all in your mind when you're thinking about responding in the moment as well. Okay, so we're going to do a little bit more talking with survivors. Of course, I assume everybody on this call would not be judgmental, but it doesn't hurt to remind us, because I think of an example when, for myself, I always remember, here are the times when I feel challenged and feel like I am judging, as if I had a survivor in front of me who had an obvious injury, and I can think of one from the last time I worked in the courthouse, was sitting in front of me with a very badly broken nose and bruises under her eyes and bruises under on her arms, and her saying, nope, she's not experiencing anything. She's fine. Everything's going on in her relationship is just dandy. She doesn't know why the law enforcement was called. And what I had to remind myself is that she was more afraid of the person waiting for her outside the door than she was of me. I was safe. I didn't go home with her at night. I wasn't going to be living with her 24/7. She was more afraid of the person waiting outside in the hallway to give her a ride home. And so that was a good reminder for me about when my judgment comes up. So we all have those places, and it'll be different for each one of you. It's just helpful to be aware of it and just to remember that we're intersecting for just like a moment in this person's life, and that we don't live with them 24/7 or hold that big picture in mind. And instead, you know, if I could have redone that conversation again, now with the experience I have, I would have said to her, I'm really glad to hear that. You know, if something should be changed in the future, I want you to know I'm here, that you can call anytime or as many times as you want. Here's some information that's free and confidential about advocates in our community. You know, would you like you want me to give you that on a smaller piece of paper? Do you want this big piece of paper? What would work for you? And just know that we're here. So the other thing that's important to keep in mind is it is okay to share your concerns with the patients in front of you. You see the second bullet point, share information. I think it is totally fine if you can do this in a non-judgmental way, just being direct, kind, and warm to say to people, based on what you told me, I am concerned about you. I am concerned about what's been happening to you. And try to understand from her perspective what she's most afraid of, because she may have an injury that seems serious, but what she's most afraid of is the last time he took the children and was gone for 3 days and she didn't know where her children were. So trying to figure out what her fears are and what her biggest concern is will help you keep the door open for future conversations and will help you with any feelings you might have about questioning her decisions about what choices she's making in the moment. Finding out what her fears are can be really helpful for that, because you can be surprised. I think also, like anyone else, we've all been in relationships. There can be a lot of, we've all been in relationships where we've had to exhaust every option before we decide that we want to terminate the relationship. And again, these issues are totally compounded if you don't have access to the money in the relationship, if language is a barrier, if there's not safe, affordable, accessible housing in your community, if even transportation is a problem in your community, all those things compound the choices and impact the choices the survivor's going to make to try to keep a roof over her head for herself and her children. And, you know, I have certainly heard from survivors over the years tell me there's so much grief in having to let go of what you hoped the relationship would be, and that there's a lot of sadness around that. And if this person is the father of your children, and, you know, as we said in the beginning, even though I was showing you some scary information about abusers who have committed homicide, we have to remember that not all people who are abusive are alike, and maybe this person only experiences physical or sexual violence a couple times a year and can live with the other coercive tactics that are happening because she doesn't see how she's going to get it together, first month, last month's rent, access to a job, do all these things if her abuser has really limited her options within her life, kept her from going to school or kept her from getting ESL classes or belittled her in front of her friends or even made it difficult for her to keep a job because she's been calling constantly, showing up, harassing her at the workplace. So all those pieces are not all illegal acts and can really narrow the options in a person's life, and it takes quite a bit of planning before a person can figure out what they want to do. And there are some people who don't want the relationship to end, but they want the coercive tactics and the violence to end. So again, you may be working with a patient who says yes to things happening, but doesn't want to leave the relationship, wants to stay in contact with this person, but wants that person to get help or wants to figure out how to survive. So, for instance, if you all work in closed communities where it's very difficult for people to step outside their community to get service, I'll use my own experience of volunteering in an Orthodox Jewish community. Those, by and large, many of those folks that I volunteer to do advocacy with are not stepping outside their community to get services, and they're not leaving the relationship. But in my advocacy role, I have to help them figure out how to stay safe and how to figure out how to bring the community in, have the community have a role in helping to hold this person who's abusive accountable. Okay, let's have a little break, and if you all want to send in some more questions, I'm going to take a look at these and we'll respond to them. Okay, so I saw two questions about that were very specific questions that lets me know you all have had experience already hearing your patients talk to you about their domestic violence issues and want some pretty specific help. So one question, a person is afraid to file police reports, I'm assuming, because so if they do go forward and file for restraining orders or a divorce, there isn't historical information to prove the abuse. Okay. So we are going to talk a little bit more about how advocates can help you, how partnering with domestic violence advocates and those programs do have legal advocates can help you deal with these specific information, specific kinds of questions. So I'm going to hang on to that question. I'm going to circle it, and we're going to get back to it a little bit more. Again, with the question that says the survivor doesn't want the police call because she has outstanding tickets and she doesn't want to be arrested, again, this is something that a domestic violence advocate can help a survivor deal with. She can actually help her resolve her maybe outstanding parking ticket situation. There could even be, who knows, there could even be an arrest if the parking tickets get bad enough, or it could be warrants out for other kinds of issues. Domestic violence legal advocates can help survivors resolve those issues, and we'll talk a little bit more about how that works. Was there a documentation question about charting or this stuff?
No, I mean documentation.
Okay, and we'll also talk about why somebody might not want to have any kind of documented information about the domestic abuse, because that person may understand that telling someone in a court might make things actually worse for her at home, and would like to be able to exit, feels like she could actually exit the relationship more easily without revealing domestic violence in a public setting like the courts. But we'll get back to that in a little bit. Okay. So back to our framework, assess. So now we're talking about immediate safety concerns. Someone has told you, yes, something's happening. You've been supportive and made a connection and reassured them while it's difficult and painful that you're here for them, it's not their fault, and you hope that you can continue to talk about it. So the role of this webinar is not to turn you all into the same kind of safety planners that domestic violence advocates are, where that's pretty one of the bread and butter strategies that they spend a lot of time doing. But we want to give you some tools that you feel like you can assess for immediate safety concerns with the person who's in front of you. So here are some questions that you could be asking. Where is the partner now? When are they coming back? Do they feel safe to go home today? What's their plan? And again, you might not wanting to be use the word future violence. You might want to be saying, like, what have they done in the past? What's their plan? If things like this start to happen again where they get worried, do they feel comfortable calling 911? Many of your folks, they may not be. Do they feel comfortable talking with anyone else? Asking them if there's one thing that could be done to support them today, what would it be? If you have any concerns around someone coming back that you think need to be communicated to your coworkers, this is another reason why you want to have a plan and spend some time ahead of time with staff talking about what is our plan if one of our patients says, actually, yes, I am afraid. He is coming back here, and he's not going to be happy that I'm even here, and I don't want to leave with him. Who's going to talk to this person? Who's going to let them know that the patient doesn't want to go home with them today? What would be, how much information should be revealed to the partner who's coming back? What would be, you know, this is where you really need to rely on the expertise of the survivor to say, okay, if we want to let your partner know that you're not going to be leading with them this afternoon, let's talk about what would be some alternative things to say that would not put you in further danger ultimately when you leave. It could be, I'm going to visit my mom. It could be, I want to go, you know, do some grocery shopping. I mean, this is where you want to involve the survivor in. What are things that she said to the abuser in the past? And if she says, on the other end of it, well, there's really nothing, I'm just going to have to go home with them today. Okay, so what would help support you in that moment? What will make it easiest so that your partner doesn't suspect that anything's happened that's going to make them unhappy? So really kind of just trying to talk it through with them and not make decisions for the person, but listen, call upon their resources and strategies they've used in the past. You know, another reason why to plan and think about this ahead of time is you want to make sure any kind of safety information you may be giving out about local domestic violence programs is accessible. Maybe it needs to be in different formats, like larger print or on a tape or on a cassette tape. Well, cassette tape's not going to work anymore these days, is it? Or, you know, in a different format that would make it easier for the person to read, make sure the literacy level isn't too complicated, or is it in different languages? You also want to make sure that everyone on staff knows where the information is, that one person just isn't the keeper of all the knowledge and information. So this is a time where I would say while you're kind of trying to assess immediate safety concerns, this is, again, the time where you hopefully are also calling your local domestic violence advocate who you've already made a relationship with, and that you would be able to say to the person in front of you, I know someone, I know Jean, she works at this organization, she understands what you're going through, she's worked with other women who've been in the same situation, again, not using our jargon or language that could be off-putting. Maybe you can go into another room and talk to her, use the phone right now, or you can call 24 hours at any other time, and we'll talk more about this in a little bit. But again, this is why thinking ahead and having staff prepared as well as giving information to the individual patient will be useful. A few questions about children's safety. This might be the way into the conversation with the patient as well. Asking her what concerns she might have for her children's safety. Asking her if the partner uses the children to monitor her. So many survivors or patients may say to you, he doesn't do anything to hurt the children, but asking questions to get at, but does he use the children to say where you've been or who you're talking to or where you're going? Does he use the children to try to monitor her behavior? We found that is often true. So she is concerned about not doing something or doing something that wouldn't place her children in greater risk. Okay, so you're exploring options with her. You're trying to assess what's going on in the immediate safety, what she might need, what's happened in the past, how has she been able to do to help protect herself or her kids, what would work best for her. And then again, starting to bridge, helping her build a relationship with advocates in your community. And we're lucky, you know, for those listeners who are here from Washington State, we have many specialized providers in our state, and I'm going to show you resources at the end that can help connect you to it, where we're lucky that we have domestic violence advocates that speak a range of languages and have a range of programs, especially in the King County area, but also in parts of eastern Washington as well. So this is the time you also want to be able to describe advocacy resources, and so that's more than just giving someone a phone number. You want to help, you want to be able to describe what's the service like. Just like you and I want a referral to a dentist or a doctor or anybody else, we want a name. We want to know if they're any good. We want to know if you've gone, what did you think of them? You know, just that same kind of information. We really see you as dealing with folks in the moment, but it really helps facilitating that connection to advocates. So now we're going to talk about domestic violence advocates. So what I'm going to be referring to right now are advocates, again, that work in a nonprofit community-based program. The term advocate, you'll see it kind of everywhere. Advocates are employed by prosecutors' offices. They're employed by law enforcement agencies. Again, they may even work, they may be employed by a hospital. But all of those advocates that are employed in those different places have a different role and different confidentiality obligations than advocates who are employed in community-based nonprofit programs. So let's talk about that a little bit. We want to know, in order to help support you in feeling comfortable in talking about a domestic violence advocate, we want to tell you what you can expect from a program. So free and confidential services. They're going to offer a range of services to victims and their children and friends and family. It's totally a voluntary connection who've been affected by domestic violence. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what I mean by free and confidential. So free means free. There are really no charges involved with accessing domestic violence services. What confidential means is that the communications and the written documents, any kind of written documentation that domestic violence have with survivors who are using their programs are held confidential and cannot be released without explicit written permission from the survivor. And we have, in Washington State, domestic violence advocates have statutory obligations. So what that might mean for you as a healthcare provider is you've sent your patient over to see Jean at the local domestic violence program. You've said, you've talked to Jean ahead of time, actually. You've had Jean come do a brown bag lunch at your clinic and talk about their services. She's come and spent 15 minutes and explained all the things that they do, talked about accessibility, talked about how they get interpreters, talk about how they can work with folks who are deaf or speak other languages, what their process is. So you've got a pretty good understanding of what services are. However, if you call to find out if your patient actually connected to Jean's program, the program folks are not going to tell you. And it's not because they're trying to be difficult, but their confidentiality obligations require them not to to neither confirm nor deny if someone has sought services. Some programs you talk to would say something possibly like, I can take information, and if the Jean you're talking about ever comes to this program, I may be able to pass that along. That's the best I can do. Or if someone like Jean comes to our program, I could pass that information along. And then Jean would have to make the choice whether to call you or not. So that's a piece that's a little bit different. I know I've talked to folks in healthcare settings who are used to having their referrals confirmed. They want to know if someone actually connected. And you're not going to get that confirmation from the domestic violence program. You would get it from your patient. That's the only way you would get it. So there's a little bit of a face there, but it also should be comforting to know that if anyone in Jean's family or the abuser's family is looking for Jean, and no matter what they say, they're not going to get a hint of whether Jean has used that service or not. So that's will be useful for you. 24-hour crisis line assistance, individual or group meeting support, and that usually provides free child care as well. Many of our programs around the state, at a minimum, would have some kind of emergency housing, but many of the programs are really working on building longer-term transitional and even permanent housing. Again, in Region 10, there are many, at the four states that are in Region 10, there are many Housing First initiatives that focus on building longer-term safe and affordable housing for victims. They're going to help folks with accessing all the resources possible in the community, including financial resources, and trying to connect them to all services. So let's talk a little bit more about what advocates do philosophically. What is their approach to their work? So they're going to believe what the patient, your patient, the survivor is telling them. They're going to help support her decision-making, hear what her priorities are. They're going to help her plan for safety and the abuser reaction. So that's where this safety planning thing gets complicated. So safety planning could change from day to day depending on what the survivor wants to do and how she thinks her abuser will react to it, which could be anything from, you know, I want to try to get a job, or I want to enroll in this ESL class, or I want to put my children at this school. She really has to think through what the how the abuser will react, and advocates spend a lot of time helping folks think that through. So to go back to that question we had way earlier in the hour about, is there any way to take legal steps safely? There absolutely could be, but it has to be a part of a larger framework of safety planning. Timing is really important, and the survivor is going to be expert and know best when that can happen. So, I see we have some more questions in, and I'll take a break in a few moments and get to those questions. I'm just going to get through these next couple slides, and then we'll break again. There are legal advocates at our domestic violence programs as well, and they are not attorneys, but they are very knowledgeable in the area of domestic and sexual violence, and they can help explain the criminal and civil systems, the pros and cons of using whatever option that's available, and help with that timing piece. They also, advocates, work with all the other systems or resources as well, like housing, public benefits, healthcare, CPS. And part of advocates' job in our community is identify problems in the system and work on it. So it's not just connecting people to like a food bank resource. It's like, what are the problems that are happening in the court setting, or what are problems, is CPS following its own rules? Are there problems with the family violence option in TANF? Are they doing everything they're supposed to be doing? And advocating for that individual patient to get what they need, but then also going back and pushing at the system to either follow the rules that already exist and they're not really following them, or help shape and change the rules to make it to make the benefit greater for survivors of domestic violence and their children. So it's more than just connecting people to phone numbers. Advocates will go wherever your patient survivor needs them to go and help them navigate any system that they need to navigate, for as long as they want the service. Again, it's voluntary. So let's just talk, let me just go back and talk a little bit about the safety planning again. So I think you've gotten by now that it's pretty complicated and that we're trying to help folks plan for safety, knowing their danger may increase after they leave, and that leaving must be planned, and maybe she'll have to leave and come back because it takes a while to build resources and strategies. It's really critical, even if the abuse hasn't been physical, and it's, so this is where partnering with advocates is important. So for you all, in thinking again about how to act in the moment, you're just trying to figure out what the person's immediate safety needs are sitting in front of you, what they might want after they leave your, how to respond to what people might need after they leave your actual office, and really trying to help facilitate that connection to advocates in the community. So I'm going to just talk a little bit, just give you a little bit about confidentiality, and then I'll get to some of your questions. So again, confidentiality for domestic violence advocates, and so they have actually fairly similar obligations, I would say, to folks in the healthcare setting, except that they're not going to be doing any information sharing with you. And I think you've gotten by now how important confidentiality is to safety planning, because it's vital for the person who's experiencing abuse to have as much control over the information he or she discloses as possible, because they're always trying to figure out and anticipate how the abuser will react to systems or individuals knowing what's going on. So that really means there's going to be a limitation to information sharing and collaborative relationships. You're not going to get specific information about your patient you've referred to the program without her explicit permission. And just so that you know, there are federal and state statutes that require DV programs and the advocates, including the volunteers, to act in this way. What I can tell you for all the advocates in Region 10 who work in community-based programs, generally confidentiality or privilege applies when survivors work with staff and volunteers at community-based agencies. And just to state again, this privilege does not apply to advocates who are employed by or under the direct supervision of a law enforcement agency, a prosecutor's offices, or child protective services. They will be sharing information about the person with others in the system. So it's helpful to say to the patient survivor in front of you, you know, these advocates that I'm sending you to are not going to share information or say any talk about what you've talked about with them unless you give them permission. If you want them to talk to the prosecutor about your case, they can do that. But if you don't want them to, they can't without your permission. If you want them to share information with the mental health therapist that you're going to see and you want your therapist to know your advocate, they can do that. But if you don't want them to, they can't. There are some exceptions to privilege, and again, very similar to what your exceptions would be too, tariffs off warning, duty to warn of harm to self or others, and then all the, again, domestic violence advocates are subject to mandatory reporting requirements with child abuse and vulnerable adult abuse. And that's a little bit different in each state, and there's a resource at the end I'm going to give you that can you can look up sort of thumbnail sketches of the requirements for each state around child abuse and vulnerable adult slash elderly slash disabled. But because of the time constraints, we're not going to discuss the specifics for each state. So it's important that you get familiar with the guidelines in your state. But I will show you towards the end a resource where you can at least get a brief overview. So I'm going to take a moment here and look at your questions. Okay. Didn't check the DV box because she didn't know what would happen. Right. What about personal disclosures? That means. Okay. Have a restraining order, safety plan. How many times has filed before it comes to court with a restraining order?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything else that goes with it?
No. Can a judge subpoena advocate records? Okay. All right, y'all had some fabulous questions. I think I'm just going to work through some of these, and I'm going to restate them, the question, and if I've really botched it, someone can jet us off the question in the chat feature. So I'm going to go with a patient didn't check the abused domestic violence box on our form because she didn't know what would happen next. Would her husband be arrested? So, and what would really happen? So let's just, one thing we can be really clear about. In Region 10, all four of the states we're talking about, there is no mandatory reporting requirement for adult domestic violence, except in some exceptions around folks with disabilities slash vulnerable adult. But that's a different legal category. It's a specific definition of who meets that, and we won't be doing a training on that today. But rest assured, you can tell people as they're filling out the form, you know, if there's anything on here outside of child abuse, for instance, you might say that, that you check, this is confidential information. Now, so if someone checked the box, domestic violence, no, it does not mean they get arrested. What literally would happen is you would be talking to that person. They would have you would be taking that next step of saying, I see that you've checked this box. Can you tell me what's going on right now? Are you feeling unsafe at home? Is there something you want to share with me in particular? I really feel glad that you felt like you could check this box here. It's really important for me to know how you that you feel comfortable here. It makes us feel good. We want to support you. So just checking the box does not trigger criminal legal response. What about using personal disclosure? So I'm assuming you mean telling about maybe abuse that happened in your own life, in your past. I think you have to be really careful about that because some people might say, well, that's her abuse story, but that's not my abuse story, or that didn't happen to me. If you've had a long-term relationship with someone and you feel like it's an opportunity to talk about something that happened to you as a way to give a person hope and help them see that it's possible to take steps forward when they're really afraid, you know, being able to frame it in a more positive way. I just would be really careful about that. I certainly wouldn't use it early on in a relationship. I think you could say, again, I'm very concerned about what I'm hearing. I'm concerned for your safety. I've heard stories like this from other folk. Hopefully that's true. Other people, you're not alone. Other people have been in this situation. So maybe using drawing on more broader analogies and collections of stories that you've heard from other survivors rather than your own individual example. Question was, the person had a restraining order with the safety plan. How many times is it violated before it becomes criminal? Well, in our state and in many states, there are several kinds of protective orders. Protective order is the big umbrella term. And under that, there are several kinds of orders. Most states have what's called a domestic violence protective order. A restraining order, usually a part of divorce or legal separation or paternity. In many states, you don't have to allege domestic violence. You don't have to talk about domestic violence to get a restraining order. You do have to talk about domestic violence to get a domestic violence protection order. So for some survivors, it's safer for them to have a restraining order where they didn't have to talk about it to get it, even though there are boxes on the restraining order that may say, don't harass, don't molest, don't hurt this person. So everybody calls protective orders all kinds of things. And again, this is the job of the domestic violence advocate to know the differences about the orders in each one of your states and help her figure out which is the safest order for her to get. Okay, to go back to your question, though, how many times is it violated before it comes criminal? Complicated answer. In every one of these orders, these civil protective orders, there are criminal provisions and civil provisions. If the criminal provisions are violated, then the person is subject to arrest. If the civil provisions are violated, then they're not subject to arrest, and it's a different process entirely to go back to court and show that the order's been violated. Again, good idea to have a DV advocate helping you. If this person who wrote me this question, there already is a DV advocate involved because they suggested they use the word there's a safety plan, it is really frustrating sometimes. To get response from, it just depends on what provision of the order was violated. So, for example, if the restraining order says you're supposed to bring home the children every day at 6 and he doesn't bring them home every day till 8, that's terrifying, that's frustrating, that's scary. The survivor's wondering where everybody is, but it's not a criminal violation. It would be a civil violation. A criminal violation might be he brings the kids home and then socks her, punches her, or has contact with her when he's not supposed to have contact with her. So the big question is, how the order was violated? And then there's lots of complicated stuff that happens afterwards, but the advocate can help bring the concerns of your patient, who's a survivor, to the attention of the prosecutor's office, to the attention of the law enforcement agency, and ask about the kind of enforcement or response that they're getting, if that's what the survivor wants. Let's see. Can a judge subpoena advocates' records? Yes, an advocate's records can be subpoenaed, but the bar has been raised very high now on confidentiality and privilege of domestic violence program records. So just because they're subpoenaed doesn't mean they're going to get them. We always encourage, in the role of the coalition, any program that gets subpoenaed to not voluntarily hand over records, but to say, to engage in an attorney, and there's usually an attorney on their board or someone who can help them, to go back in court and request the judge to review the records in chambers and decide what information, if any, could be released to prosecution or a defense attorney or a family law attorney, and what information has to be covered up, blacked out, or redacted So nobody should be voluntarily handing off any information, just like actually in the healthcare setting. Someone should be slowing down that process, saying no, and then limiting, and then making the judge limit what information gets revealed. Time limit for working with a DV victim. There is no time limit for advocates. They can work with the victim as long as the victim wants them to work with them. Average length of time really, really varies. You could have somebody who's moving through your community and is going to relocate back with the family, and so the average length of time with the advocate could be really small. Or I know there are programs where women attend support groups for a couple of years, use their housing program for as long as they can, check in every now and then on the crisis line. Just really up to the survivor. Yes, mandatory. Okay, another question. Mandatory reporting when kids are involved and how it impacts the survivor's safety. That is a great question and so true. So if you find you're in a position of having to make a mandatory child abuse report, we really encourage you, and I would be saying the same thing to a domestic violence advocate, to let the patient / survivor know your obligations, what has to happen, and ask her to be involved in it with you. She could possibly be in the room when you're making the report, but that you're doing it over the phone. Talk to her about how this is going to impact her safety. So work it through. What's going to be like when CPS calls your husband or calls the school or calls the boyfriend? What do you think is going to happen? How can we help you think about your safety? Is there friends or family you need support from? Be as transparent about what has to happen as possible because, again, she's the expert on her safety and her children's safety. And even though she may be freaked out and that's scary for you, too, it'd be like, oh, my God, that's not what I wanted to have happen. I didn't want you calling those people. And so talking to her about your obligation and saying, acknowledging what you're hearing from and her fears and say, what is your biggest fear? Let's help figure out the next steps of what you can do. It's a hard conversation, but you don't want to sever your relationship and you want her to know that she can come back to you and talk to you about the hard stuff. Behaviors advocates need to avoid so they don't become the target of the abuser. Well, again, the confidentiality piece is really important. So when, helping her think through her safety, advocates may be asking her, does he monitor your phone calls on your cell phone? Does he monitor your history on the computer? Does he monitor who you talk to? Do you have GPS in your car? She might need to use a computer at a library. She may need to use a computer at somebody else's house. She may need to take the battery out of her cell phone so the GPS device isn't activated. So, again, advocates work through, try to hear from the survivor all the ways the abuser is trying to maintain dominance in the relationship. It's not just about physical or sexual violence. And help think through practical ways to protect and control information and how she's contacting. Advocates won't be leaving a message on her answering machine phone. Hi, they won't be saying, call me when you get a moment. They'll be saying, what's the times I should call you? What's the place I should call you? If we're going to go to this place, should I meet you? Should you come with me? Should you come with your friend? They'll be thinking through all those things. They have experience. And, it's another reason to partner with your program is they can help you think about safety of staff on site and planning for what to do. I mean, you could have abuse happening. And, again, think about this for your fellow coworkers. Abuse could be happening happening to staff that work at your agency. I think probably given the number of people on this call, it probably already has. How do you protect the confidentiality of the information? How do you make sure the staff person isn't penalized for having to take time off to seek support or deal with issues? How do you help them connect with advocates? All those same things. Last question, abuse in one county. Okay, so if a person is experiencing abuse in one area.
One county, and then they went to another county, but the court happened in that first county.
Basically, in most of, I'm sure this is true throughout Region 10, and I know it's true for Washington, you can file for an order wherever it's convenient for you to file. You don't have to go back to the county or the city which the abuse occurred. I hope we're getting at that question, but, the orders have confidential places for information around location, and in some of our orders, protective orders, you only have to list the county you're residing in at the moment. So you don't have to go back to the courthouse where the abuse occurred to take steps. And again, advocates can help with those nuances and figure out what works for people. Okay, everybody, that was a long break. Good job. Okay. So we're back to talking with survivors again, and we're moving into documentation. Sure. I think we've all gotten it by now with me answering your questions as well, how important confidentiality of records are. But, you know, stating the obvious for survivors of domestic violence is okay. I would really encourage you to assure the person in front of you who's disclosed domestic violence that your records are confidential and that that person, their abusive partner, can't get a copy easily and see. You know, even under HIPAA, I know that you have an opportunity to pause if the abuser wanted a copy of the records and she had signed the HIPAA form. You have an ability to literally kind of make a pause and decide what information is relevant to be released and what isn't. And if it's not relevant to her medical condition for the husband or whoever she's given permission to see about domestic violence, I would redact that from your files. And we know confidentiality may be even more important issue for undocumented women. They may be, the abuser may be totally using their fear of their shaky legal status to report them. And again, in many of our states, and certainly Washington, there are domestic violence advocacy programs that work specifically, have expertise specifically on helping undocumented women. There are many options under the Violence Against Women Act, not many, but more than there used to be, for women who are undocumented, who have no legal status, to receive protection, who are experiencing domestic violence. And luckily, we have advocates who are experienced in those issues. Again, if a woman has a substance abuse issue, the abuser may be threatening to take her children away or talk to other people about her substance abuse issues. So, again, it's really important to assure the person in front of you that even if the person requests copies of the records, you can take a moment and pause and figure out what information is really relevant to be released and what isn't. Okay. So, doing that, thinking about follow-up, remembering that there isn't a quick fix, that survivors are going to often need long-term support, you, the healthcare provider, are not alone, that you now have better tools about where to turn for help, that you can seek consultation on an ongoing basis from your local domestic violence advocate that you've made a friend with, or your agency or your clinic has made a friend with. Remembering that disclosing information and leaving is a dangerous time. Remembering that many survivors want to stay in the relationship. I'm sure you all have had that experience. One thing we want to say, though, that's very, very important is that you don't want to recommend couples counseling or anger management. There's tons of research now. We can say like 30 years of research that indicates, even though it may seem counterintuitive, that couples counseling and anger management is not appropriate when domestic violence is present because couples counseling assumes, in 25 words or less, that there is equal balance of power in the relationship, and folks living with domestic violence are experiencing an imbalance in power. And no matter how willing or nice the person who's abusive may seem and open to treatment, whatever the survivor reveals in a couples counseling setting can be used by the abuser against her. And she probably wouldn't feel very comfortable revealing that much anyway. If someone who's abusive says that they think they need help, they need to see someone who has training in what we call batterers intervention treatment in Washington State, has other names in other states, but it is not anger management, which really focuses on teaching people how to do impulse control. And actually, you would just be giving an abuser better skills to manipulate the partner that they're targeting their coercive behavior towards. You know, and there are other risks associated with anger management. They include creating a false sense of security. They don't address the power and control dynamics. And they, again, can teach batterers tactics that become new elements of coercion. You may have patients saying, I want my partner to get help. So you would tell her, that is fabulous. We want to help this person get help too. And in Washington State, And, again, your domestic violence program can recommend to you locally who are the therapists or the agencies that are providing appropriate intervention treatment for people who are abusive. And if she says to you, he won't go to counseling unless I go too, then that's a sign that, again, they're not really looking at the issue as a problem, and I would make her aware of what you are concerned about if she is in a couple counseling setting, that she has to be very careful about what she talks about that's not used against her later by her abusive partner. And so, you know, does she think that that really would be the best option? And do you think it's possible that he might consider doing counseling on his own? We know many women don't want their relationships to end. They just want the violence and the coercion to stop. Okay, so documentation. Again, you're letting the victim slash patient know that the documentation is confidential, but she can get a copy of it. That's very important. State the obvious. Your notes and charts, I know people do a range of things from electronic charting now, but there are some basics that we want to make sure that you include. You want to include the date, time, and place, and you want to identify the relationship. You don't want to just say person came in, hit in the head. You want to say how that happened. If you're more specific and you're more clear in describing what happened, then if someone is going to request medical records and it's going to become a part of the court process, you're less likely to be subpoenaed if you're more accurate and inclusive in what you're recording in your records. So we want you to be specific. For instance, a bad example is patient was hit with a flying brick, as if the brick had wings. A better way to write that might be Mary Smith was struck on the head with a brick by her husband, John Smith. You want to use the actual names and any identifiable information you have pertaining to the abuser, because if you just said boyfriend, the perpetrator could say in court, she has a lot of boyfriends, it wasn't me. You might be having to, again, assuring about the confidentiality of the charts. You want to describe the mechanism of the injury. You don't want to use the word alleged. You want to include the patient's statements in quotes. You know, you really want to treat this information. An example I think about it is, I know there's special regulations under HIPAA for alcohol or drug or HIV status. You want to treat domestic violence information the same way, even though our laws don't specifically state so. But if you treat information about domestic violence with that same kind of confidentiality, it would actually help protect you and the survivor. So you want to include information with victim safety in mind. So you want to keep that information secure. You want to keep it in a confidential section of the chart. You want to think about who sees that information, even within your clinic setting, and how it's displayed. I'm trying to think of another example. You know, you might be looking at, even if someone doesn't disclose domestic violence, but you see belt marks or you see friction burns or you see bruises in some various stages of healing, as well as maybe inconsistency in a story or description of the injury, you know, those are things that can help you just give a little more information and remind her that you're glad, you know, that you're there for her to talk about it again in the future. You might want to think about doing a follow-up training just to look at documentation specifically, but you want to make sure that whoever does provide the training is really clear about what your documentation practices are in your specific facility, especially if you all use things like body maps or photography. Remember, photography requires a patient's permission. You want to include, if you had a follow-up training, risk management staff as well, or any of the staff responsible for records transmittal, because that's when we get back to people that may know the abuser or people that she's given permission in the HIPAA form to grant copies of her records to, and you want to still, if domestic violence has been indicated in that record, you want to have some way in the system to slow things down and figure out, do I need to reveal, is this information relevant, or do we need to redact or remove the information about domestic violence. So you want to have a process in place to slow that down. Just some of the obvious stuff. Clear handwriting is really helpful. You're less likely to be subpoenaed if people can read your handwriting. in my experience. If you can record your opinions corroborating the abuse, in this example on the slide, trauma is consistent with being struck from behind with a baseball bat, being really clear about that. And again, just exercising a little caution, the documentation can be misinterpreted or used against a person in a legal case, meaning like later on in family court. So, you know, if someone's trying to get custody of their children and the abuser actually, abuser's attorney requests your records and uses things that are set in the record to his advantage. So you want to make sure, especially, for instance, if you're noting mental health diagnosis, that you connect it to the impact of the abuse on the person's life. So it's not just that they're depressed, but they're depressed as a result of, you know, their husband limiting all contact with family and friends, or having her get fired from her job because he was calling every other day. You know, just connect it to the how the impact of the abuse, how it impacted that person's life. Okay. We're almost have a little break. I've got a few more questions. Take a look at these.
What is this first one? Engage at HS students?
Okay. Do they have any problems?
Okay, very good questions. Quickly, there are programs around that are focusing on teen dating violence. The Coalition, for instance, we've just developed a tool to help educate community members about teen dating violence that can be used as a community education tool. If you go to our website, you'll see it, Teen in Her Shoes. Lots of individual programs are doing different stuff to work on prevention, which includes teen dating violence, obviously, and messaging. They're really unique sort of program to program, but yes, those efforts are going on, and I'm sure they're going on in the other regions and states, and they are going on nationally. There are resources that you can go to that we'll talk about at the end that will link you to that. What if she doesn't know she's being abused? What do you say? I think it again goes back to I'm glad that that's not happening to you right now. Should that ever change, you're there for her to talk to, and you know, you can't in the moment say to somebody, I don't believe you. You know, you've had this chronic injury that is a result of X, Y, and Z, and I'm really concerned. You know, I just don't think that that's true. I think you just got to keep the door open and let her know that if anything should ever change, you're there for her to talk to. You're concerned about her health. You're concerned about creating conditions at home that can support what you're doing here in the healthcare setting. What can you do at home to help support that? You know, just trying to build that trust and relationship. I know that that's very hard and frustrating. I still would give advocacy information. There are also people that can help you. I wouldn't be using violence or DV violence in those words, that you're here to talk to if you just want to talk to about your troubles, how things are going, just usual, tensions and concerns in any relationship. It comes up for everyone. It's nice to know that there's a place to call. Just try to help make those connections. There's different estimates on how long it takes a person to leave a relationship before they leave for good, depending on what the other barriers are to accessing any system. But, you know, about the research out there says about 7 times, and you could think, you know, if you didn't have access to money or English wasn't your first language or if you lived in an area that wasn't very accessible for your disability or there wasn't good transportation, you can just imagine how long it might take to build up the resources and get things in place. And if you had hope that your partner would change, that would have to be factored into. Ways to handle situations when DV perpetrators are police officers. Yes, that really does happen, and good question, and that, you know, that really does need skilled advocacy. I would connect with domestic violence advocates. I would let the patient know if you're seeing a patient who's married to someone in law enforcement or their boyfriend's in law enforcement, I would say you're very concerned about their access to equipment and ways that they can access information about you and track and know what's going on. And it may be really important to even seek advocacy help even outside your community, depending on the perpetrator. The officer may have a very, you know, close relationship with the DV program. Maybe he's on the board. Maybe he comes to the task force meetings, or she comes to task force meetings. So sometimes you have to seek domestic violence advocacy services with another agency outside your community. But, yes, advocates have training. We do have specific laws around officer-involved domestic violence in our state of Washington, and there may be others in the other state, but you need skilled advocacy to really help think through safety planning and what decisions to do next. Okay.
One more.
Okay. So many clients are referred to anger management couples counseling. I'm really glad you brought that up. If the person who sent in the question asking about the name of the program that's appropriate for PERPs rather than anger management, if you're in Washington State, if you go to the DSHS website, there is a place where you can find all the state-certified batterers treatment programs in the state. And shorthand for anyone who's not from Washington, if you call any domestic violence program in your community or the state coalitions, and I'm going to give you those resources at the end, they can tell you how to find out the state-certified or best batterers treatment programs in your community closest to you. So we'll get there. Okay, we only have about a half an hour left in this call, and I wanted to do a little bit of practicing. I had three scenarios, but we're going to just do one case study because I'd like to get through the rest of our information. So I'm going to pick. I get to pick the case study. Let's see. And then I'm going to have you all say what you would do. All right, let's go to case study number two. Everyone, take a minute and read this. Okay, I hope everyone's read case study number two. My question to you all is, I've got a couple of questions for you. One, how would you respond? How would you separate Shelly and her husband in order to speak to Shelly alone? And then I'm going to ask you another question after that. So, anybody want to try to answer that? Okay, I'm going to look at your chat. Okay, so one person said they would call the police. There's an order in place. Now, let me ask this group and this person, are you going to call the police before you talk to Shelly? Does Shelly know you're calling the police? Would Shelly want you to call the police after Shelly has this baby and has to go home? If her police, if her husband's been arrested, who's going to help her? Okay, so those are just food for thought to the person who said call the police. I would say we got to slow down and let Shelly know what her options are. One of them could be calling the police, but Shelly, you know, this is a civil order for protection. Shelly, you don't have to call the police. It's up to Shelly there. Okay, so someone answering the how would you get the folks, people separated so you could talk to them? You would tell the husband that we need to do some tests, take him to a different room, tell him he has no choice, call security if he refuses, then talk to the patient privately. would have her admitted overnight for hospital observation of contractions, try to get her in a separate room again, like testing. I love this one, like a bathroom. I think that's always very good. I don't know too many abusers who want to follow their wife into the bathroom and watch her pee into the cup or whatever she's supposed to be doing. And then go step in there and talk to her in the bathroom. I think that's a great idea. See if you can get the husband to stay in the waiting room. Take her the x-ray. He'll definitely have to stay outside the room. Yes, you can pretend x-rays and talk to her. I think that's a great idea. So it sounds like you've got some creative thinking about how to get, how to separate them. Tell him we always, tell the husband we always give every client one-on-one time. Yes, he might want to come with you to hear what you have to say in that situation. So I think things like getting her into the bathroom, getting her to another place for testing, whisking her along, anything that can like sort of physically create a barrier that seems reasonable are all good suggestions. Okay, so would you talk, here's my question back to you all again. Would you talk to the husband about the existence of the court order? And if you would, if you are you going to talk to the husband in front of the patient? Or are you going to talk to the husband alone? And what are you going to say? So let's see what people have to say about that. Okay. Oh, I see a few more. Okay. So, in our ideal setting, as a healthcare provider in your clinic, in your hospital setting, you would have had a plan for what are you supposed to do when patients give you protection orders and how you're going to respond if the abuser comes to the medical setting in violation of the order. So that's with hindsight we get to do that. So everybody who said they would talk to Shelley first about the protection order and ask her if she felt comfortable with you talking to her husband about the fact that the order is in place and would like him to leave, or does she want him to stay, or just checking it out with her, that would be my first order of business, to say, to remind her, Shelley, I know you've given us a copy of this order. He's here now. I'm concerned about your, you know, health. I'm concerned about the baby's health, as someone said. What would you want to have happen? What would be most supportive of you right now? Because we can ask him to leave, and this is the way we can do it. So Shelley might want to know how that's going to happen. She might be worried if you ask him to leave that you don't handle it well, but if you say to him, if you're able to explain to her how you would do it, you would say, I'm not going to do this alone. I would have security with us. We're not going to do it. We're going to ask him to step outside. We're not going to do it in front of other patients in the waiting room. We're going to ask him to step to this area that's private. We're going to say we have a copy of the protection order. We're not going to even say Shelley gave us a copy of the protection order. You can say we have a copy of the protection order from the court. It says here that you're not supposed to be within X feet of Shelley. So we're going to have to, according to our, you know, hospital rules or clinic rules, we have to honor protection orders. It's a liability for us. And so we're going to have to ask you to leave. So trying to take the focus off of Shelley as much as you can and say you're following your own procedures and, you know, we're going to have to ask you to leave and give him an opportunity to leave. If he doesn't leave and he's belligerent or angry with any of you all, you can say, you know, in that case, we're going to have to call law enforcement and step away and have someone else, you know, ready with a signal from you, a head nod or a pointed finger or whatever, to call law enforcement and be able to say, you know, law enforcement's on their way now. Giving him, again, an opportunity to leave, but I wouldn't, you know, have him be not in anyone's view or not be visible. I wouldn't just walk away and leave him alone. So that's, again, having a plan with security about who's going to be there, who's going to wait until law enforcement arrives. And there's a good chance he'll leave and won't wait. But you want to be thinking about your security generally. So is he hanging out in the parking lot, just sitting in the car waiting for Shelley? Because maybe it's preterm labor, I don't know, and she's going to have to come back. Or maybe Shelley also wants you, when you're talking to her, to call mom or call friends, call other family members to help come and be a support for her. What if there's no security available? Okay. So, again, it's really important to have a plan, and that could include having a relationship with local law enforcement, saying, if we are trying to work out practice and policies for when patients give us protection orders that at some point might require us to have assistance because their partners come to our healthcare setting. So if that should happen, because we don't have staff security here, we'd like to know, you know, who should we call? Should we just be calling 911, or should we be calling someone within the police department agency? So you would have, like, a phone number, a contact for 24/7, around the clock, what law enforcement person is, how would that policy be in place? So the law enforcement agency knows what to expect and that you would be calling from assistance. And, again, I would go through those same steps of letting the person know, if Shelley wanted you to, that, you know, the clinic or the hospital has received a protective order. They have to follow, you have to follow your own policies and procedures. You have a relationship with the local law enforcement agency. You're giving them an opportunity to voluntarily leave now. If not, law enforcement will be contacted and ask you to leave. Again, giving them an opportunity. You can still ask that same law enforcement to cruise the parking lot for you, make sure the person's gone out of the area. You can also, if you have that relationship, see if they would help, depending on how Shelley feels, would she need, you know, you want to make sure that he doesn't know when she's leaving the hospital setting. Would she need law enforcement escort back out to her car when it's time to go? Anything like that. So, again, we've got the ideal of hindsight in this conversation, but having those kind of relationships with local law enforcement and the advocacy programs can be really important, because you could also have an advocate talking to Shelley if she had to be in the hospital for a while. You could have an advocate come in and just talk about resources. It's nothing she's required to do. Let's see. What if Shelley doesn't want him to leave, but we have a policy not allowing him to stay? It's still important for you to ask Shelley what she hopes could happen and then say to her, Shelley, these are the things that we can honor about what you're saying, but, and I understand how you're feeling, but we have a policy here at the clinic that if he, or at the hospital, that if there's a protective order in place and if he shows up, we need to call law enforcement. And we will, again, be as discreet as possible and ask him to meet law enforcement out in the hallway, outside the building. You know, we'll be escorting him. We're not going to try to make a public scene. We'll try to be as discreet as possible. But this is our policy. And again, with the hindsight of this conversation, when Shelley initially gives you a copy of the protection order, you can tell her, that's why all staff needs to know what the policy is, what your practice is. We're happy to take this protection order, but we just want to let you know, if he shows up here, this is how we will respond. And she may be like, great. It's out of her hands. This is the policy. Okay. And the last question I see here, do we have any case studies involving DV victims' history of substance abuse and the abuser's custody threats? Not right now in this talk. We're almost out of time. I'm sorry to put you off. I'm more than welcome to talk with you more later. But I am going to, like, move on while we can to slide, let's see, working with an interpreter. Let's look at that really briefly. Things I just want to remind you all of is that the interpreter has a very specific role. So whenever possible, you want to be hiring an interpreter or using the language line, not using friends or family to interpret, because they have a specific role. They shouldn't be, reinterpreting what's being told to you. I think you all know this as medical providers. You've been there where the person said, like, talking on for 30 seconds, and the interpreter tells you two words, and you know you're not getting all the information. And especially if you're working with folks where the language is not as common in your community, or they're deaf and you're using ASL interpreters, you want to check in with the person that you're getting the interpreter for and ask them if they know the interpreter and if this interpreter is okay, because the interpreter could be aligned with the abuser or the abuser's family. So, you know, especially, again, for the deaf community and where there's, you know, limited language present in that community, you want to check out the use of that interpreter. Okay, let's keep going. One thing I want to say about civil protection orders, I think everybody got it, that they're not the answer, that they're a tool within a framework of safety planning, and timing is really important. So, but I do want to tell you that they're free, they're initiated by the victim, there's many options for release, they're enforceable across state line and tribal lands, they do not require police involvement, there, some courts you can have the hearing by phone because of a person's disability or being in shelter. They're available to minors, and in Washington State, someone from age 13 and up can be trying to get an order on their own with a parent or guardian or next friend. Again, the pros and cons, we've said this. It really is about timing. When's the best time to get it? Advocates can help folks figure that out if that's the right choice from her. It's okay to stop and start the process. It's there. The victim needs to be able to control when happens. It's okay. The court shouldn't be looking askance on someone who does that. Briefly, when the abuser is the patient, again, you can work with advocates and how to screen and respond to abusers. Remember, if someone you're working with who's abusive does reveal any suicidal or homicidal threats, your red flag should be waving in the wind. That's really important. It's important for you to actually let the partner know that there may be an increased risk to her when an abuser is suicidal. Okay, we're going to move past the break because I answered a bunch of questions and talk to you a tiny bit about laws in Region 10, just to remind you that in Region 10, the four states involved do not require mandatory reporting by medical professionals for adult domestic violence. You see the exceptions there. Workplace protections, and I've noted the states. Oop, I made a mistake in the slide. It says in the first bullet point, Oregon, Washington, and it says AL. That's Alabama. It should say Alaska, AK. So in what I've done is here's workplace protections available in all the states, which is good news. Survivors, there are laws in place that allow survivors to take time off from work without fear of being demoted or fired in these three states. You can see unemployment benefits, can't be denied health care because they're a victim of DV or SA. And you can check with the state coalitions for the details. I'm going to give you that information. But that's good for your own, again, coworkers to know. When your coworkers are dealing with domestic violence, there are protections to go to court and take care of business, and you shouldn't be demoted or fired, or you might be able to get unemployment benefits as a result of DV or stalking, certainly in Washington and Oregon. So those are good things to know. How do you find your local advocate in Region 10? Da-da-da-da-da. Here are resources. Let's go. Here's the Alaska information. And, again, this webinar will be archived, so you can come back and write all this stuff down. Don't worry right now. So, again, I'm going to give you the statewide coalitions, and you can find all the member programs, and they can help connect you to folks. Okay, the next is Idaho. The next is Oregon. Is there a dual coalition? And next is good old Washington State. And we've got also a 24-hour hotline in Washington State that's Voice and TTY shared. Here's the Washington Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs as well. Okay, now that you know, you can take simple steps. Domestic violence is complicated, but you can take simple steps to support survivors of domestic violence. If you do these four things, meet with your local advocate, review your own forms and practices, make information available to your patients and staff, partner with local programs, get comfortable with talking about the issue. So let's keep going to the national resources. So I want to tell you one thing about the first national resource in front of you. That 1-800 number can connect you to any domestic violence program in the country. You may be working with patients who say, I want to go back to Virginia. I got to go back to mom. you can call this number and find out the Virginia Coalition number, local programs. I came from Norfolk, Virginia. Is there a DV program in Norfolk, Virginia? Yes. And this hotline number will help connect you. Cool thing is we also have a national TTY hotline number. That's the telecommunication device for the deaf. And they have deaf advocates that work during kind of business hours that help follow up to make sure people actually make connections to programs that can serve them. So you see I have it broken down. Go to the next page. Get Money, Get Safe. This is great information for survivors. It provides all kind of information about economic issues, housing, financial literacy, technology, things to think about. Some of it is Washington State specific, but a lot of it is like very general information, how to find out about your credit report, just helping increase people's financial literacy and knowledge of benefits. Keep going. We're lucky in Washington State. This program is housed in Washington State, but it's available to provide national TA. They're a community-based program that does tons of work for supporting for support and advocacy for the LGBT community. Services are free. Keep going. Now, these natural resources have a little bit more health-oriented resources as well. I put the numbers where you can find examples of, I mean, the links of training materials, clinical tools, et cetera, for improving your healthcare response. I also included a specific TA and think tank around domestic violence, trauma, and mental health. We know those co-occurring issues happen so often. And that last link on there that starts www.RAIN has that brief state-by-state overview of child and elderly and vulnerable adults state reporting requirements. So you can get that in a thumbnail as well. I want to go back and just say one word again about when you look at the National Domestic Violence Hotline number, or if you talk to any of the state coalitions, you can find the resources for women who are undocumented. So, for instance, in Washington State, there's Northwest Immigrants Rights Project, but they're in Northwest Justice Project. I'm not expecting you to remember the names. I just want you to know your state coalitions can help direct you to community-based programs that provide, that have attorneys and expertise that provide free confidential services to women who are experiencing domestic violence and maybe refugee and immigrants and undocumented. So that's a really important resource because you know how trapped women can feel fear of deportation. So I think I slid in with like 6 minutes to spare. Resources around substance abuse and custody problems. Okay. The same domestic violence advocacy programs we've been talking about will know resources for substance abuse can actually help women do a ton of advocacy work in family court, working with on custody issues. If you're involved with the state, like CPS or dependency hearings, or not, you've got a private attorney and you're dealing with custody battles, advocates can help with that. How do you confirm that the translator is okay if you don't speak the language? Good question. You ask the survivor. You say, show the survivor, this is the person's name. That's who's coming to interpret. Is it okay? And it might be okay to, it might be a good idea to have some pictures that look like, you know, sad or no, or, you know, appropriate, that look like a happy adult or a no, a sad face. Like, is this okay, or an okay symbol of some kind? But I would work on trying to figure out, you know, I bet your colleagues together, if you all had a little time over lunch, like, how could we figure out either through pictures or some words, what will we need to know in some languages, just some key words or key pictures to help figure out if the interpreter coming is appropriate. Okay, so yes, this webinar will be archived, thank you, and we'll send you all the link when it's available. This is a fabulous conversation into the thank you for letting me share it with you all. Feel free, I work at the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence and have been doing work for many years with healthcare folks and have spent a lot of time in helping people think about in detail like their actual protocols or practice they might want to put together or how to connect with DV advocates. And I'm more than happy to talk with any of you all. You'll have the coalition information. I can be contacted. And thank you for your time. Have a great day.